should we read the Bible? If we read the Bible, how do we know that what it says can be trusted? And I guess something that I've really wrestled with as well is, even if academically speaking we know that it can be trusted and that it is reliable, what on earth has this super old book got to do with my life? Is it relevant to us today? So before we have a quick look at some of those questions, I just want to have a look at what is the Bible, just a very brief overview. Has anyone got any idea how many copies of the Bible sell each year? Anyone, just chuck out a number. 500,000? Okay, if I tell you that it's 100 million, is that a shock to you? 100 million copies of the Bible every single year. And probably about 10 years ago, a researcher put together a list of the top 10 selling books in the last 50 years. And this is what they came up with. You can see that Harry Potter there, you might not be able to see the numbers, that's 400 million copies in total over 50 years. And the Bible is so high that it's completely off the scale. And this was about 10 years ago, and it was 5 billion at the time. So you can see, if you look at Harry Potter, 400 million compared to the Bible, 100 million every year. This is massive. Every year it tops the bestseller list. It also tops the Kindle list, so it spans the digital age as well. It's also, interestingly, the most stolen book in the world. The Bible has been quoted by lots of different people: Stormzy, Donald Trump, Martin Luther King Jr., William Shakespeare, and it's been translated into hundreds and hundreds of different languages. And as I'm sure lots of you know, it's not just one book, it's actually made up of 66 different books, 39 in the Old Testament and 27 in the New Testament. It was written over at least 1,500 years, and it spans three different continents: Africa, Asia, and Europe. And within this collection of books, within these 66 books, there's probably about 40 different authors, some of whom are kings, some are fishermen, some are prophets, some are doctors, some are super, super educated. So you've got like the fancy, eloquent language of Isaiah. Then you've got the really cynical author of Ecclesiastes. Then you've got the super passionate Paul, who is occasionally potty mouthed and swears quite a lot in some of his books. So you've got a real difference. You've got lots of different types of literature. You've got poetry, you've got songs, you've got history, you've got sayings. So when you're thinking about the Bible, I think it's helpful just to remember that there's a lot of different stuff within this one book. And that leads us to the important question: can the Bible be trusted? I don't know if you have ever been fooled by a fake news story. I quite often get fooled on April Fool's Day. I'm really gullible. This, I think, is one of my favorite fake news stories. This was a news that actually came out in America that said in Birmingham in the UK, there are no Muslims allowed in the city. That's a genuine news story. People genuinely believed that story. But it does raise an interesting question, doesn't it? Is the Bible just fake news? How do we know that this can actually be trusted? Well, if we take that Birmingham example, how do we know that that was fake news? How do we know that there are non-Muslims within Birmingham? Anyone got any ideas? How do we know that that's not true? We've been to Birmingham. Yep, good one. Anything else? Yep, no one stopped us. We were allowed in and we're not Muslim. The other things you could do is maybe read other things about Birmingham. You could speak to people that live there. Like you say, you can visit it. You can also look at how reliable that source was. Is that a good news outlet, or is it, you know, has it told other things that aren't necessarily true beforehand? And you can actually apply all of those principles, all of those questions to the Bible. And there are other questions that you can apply as well. These four questions here are what lots of historians will apply to ancient literature, to old manuscripts. So how long after the event was it recorded? How long between the original was written down and the first copy was made? How many copies are there in existence of these original old manuscripts? And are there any outside sources, or is it just one document that's talking about the event? So we'll quickly skim through all of those. The first one: how long after the event took place was it recorded? So it's my birthday yesterday. And I didn't, because I'm a little bit boring. I just had a very quiet night in. But let's say I had a crazy wild party and lots of exciting things happened. And so this morning I went on Instagram and I made a bunch of Instagram stories about all the wild things that happened. That would be much more reliable, right, than if I waited for 50 years and then posted some Instagram stories, except it'd probably be another technology by then. I probably wouldn't even need a phone. I'd just write it on my hand. And it's the same with the Bible, in a kind of way. Christians believe that the whole of the Bible points to Jesus, but there's four books in particular that specifically hone in the events of Jesus' life and what he said and his death and his rising again. That's Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, otherwise known as the Gospels. And if we look at the Gospels, a lot of the events that were written down in the Gospels were recorded, written down within just a couple of years of Jesus' life. And so if there was fake news in those stories, if there was gross exaggerations, lots of false information, people that were alive at the time would have read that and corrected it. They'd have said, that's not true. For example, if when I went on my Instagram stories this morning, I was saying stuff that wasn't true about the party, people who were on Instagram as well that went to the party would correct me. They'd say, that's not true. So that's the first question. Let's look at the second question. How long between the original was written and then the earliest copy of that was made? Back in the day, obviously we didn't have printed things like this. Everything would have been handwritten and it took a long, long time, even if you were a speed reader. And so actually the shorter time between when the original was written and when the first copy was made, the more reliable they are. I'll deal with the second and the third question together because they're kind of related. So if we flip to the third question, how many copies of these ancient manuscripts are in existence? Obviously, the more copies that you've got in existence, the more reliable, historically speaking, a document is. If we have a quick look at this table, sorry, it's sort of very dodgy clip art, but if you look at the top line of that table, you've got Caesar, which is Julius Caesar, who was a Roman emperor. And he was writing about something called the Gallic War. And between the time that he wrote that down and the first copy was made was 1,000 years. That's a long, long time. He'd obviously long died before the first copy was made. And how many copies are in existence? 10. That is not very many. Now, if you look down at the bottom of that list, and you've got the New Testament, you can see that between the time that the original copy was made and then the first copy was made from that is only 30 years. And if you scoot along to the next line, there are 24,000 copies of those manuscripts. From a historical perspective, at least, the Bible is by far the most reliable ancient document, which is something that Bible scholars are completely agreed upon, but actually that message doesn't really get out there. So let's look at the final question. Are there any sources outside of the Bible itself which back it up? So if we go back to my party, my crazy wild party that I had last night, if there were lots of other people on Instagram this morning talking about the party, that would make you believe that I'd actually gone to that party. I'm not just making up this party to try and make you think that I'm cool and I've got lots of friends. And it's the same with the Bible or with any other ancient document. The more things there are that are talking about the same event, the more reliable it is. And so if we look again at the Bible and we take as an example the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, we can see that there were lots of other historians talking about the events in the Bible. So for instance, you've got two Roman historians, Tacitus and Suetonius, and you've got a Jewish historian called Josephus, and they're all talking about the things that are happening in the gospel accounts. They're confirming that what the gospels are saying actually happened. Now, I think it's really interesting to note that all three of those historians didn't like Jesus, and they didn't like the Christians, which I think makes what they're saying even more reliable, because they're writing about a guy that they didn't even like, but they're saying that it happened. So that's a very quick overview of the Bible, very quick overview of whether it's reliable from a historical perspective. But that brings us to what I think is probably the most important question that we're going to look at in this talk, which is the Bible relevant to me? How do I know that no matter how much it can be trusted from an academic perspective, that actually this can make a difference to my life now? I want to share with you something that my friend Nabil Qureshi shared in his book, Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus, which is actually on the table over there. It's a brilliant book. But Nabil grew up as a devout Muslim. And he was studying Christianity. And the more that he studied Christianity, the more he found that actually it intellectually satisfied him, but it also emotionally spoke to him in a way that Islam didn't. And he found himself completely conflicted because he wanted to become a Christian because he knew that actually this was true and this spoke to him. But he knew that if he did that, his whole family would turn away from him. And so he was in deep, deep distress and he was looking for comfort. And he says this, and you can read this in his book. I sat on the couch and I opened the Quran. I flicked through the pages looking for verses of comfort, at first carefully reading each page and then frantically flipping from page to page, hoping for something, anything that would comfort me. There was nothing there for me. It talked about a God who would not love me if I didn't please him, one who seemed to take joy in sending his enemies to hell. It didn't speak to the broken man in need of God's love. It didn't speak to me. It was a book of laws written for the 7th century. Looking for a living word, I put the Quran down and I picked up the Bible. I'd never read the Bible for personal guidance before. I didn't even know where to begin. I figured the New Testament would be a good start. So I opened it to the beginning of Matthew. Within a few minutes, I found these words, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted." These words were like a current sent through my dead heart, electrifying it once more. This is what I was looking for. It was as if God had written those words in the Bible specifically with me in mind, even though they were written 2,000 years earlier. And I knew that what I held in my hands was life itself. I could not put the Bible down. I ended up skipping a whole day of school, but I really had no choice in the matter. The Bible was my lifeline. Nabil obviously had a really powerful experience when he read the Bible, and he's not the only person who's ever had an experience. I'm sure there's lots of you here today who've had a really powerful experience when you've read the Bible. But that doesn't stop there being difficulties in the Bible. And I would be lying to you if I said that I understood everything in the Bible, and I would also be lying to you if I said that everything in here is really nice. I think it's fair to say that there are difficulties with the Bible. There's a book called The Badly Behaved Bible, written by a Bible scholar called Nick Page, and he says this. He says that some people think the Bible is an old, gentle book which sits quietly on the shelf gathering dust. It contains some lovely language and some beautiful stories, but there's nothing shocking about it at all. And I don't know if maybe some of you have come in thinking that the Bible is just nice, it's got lots of beautiful stories in it, but it's not shocking. But if anyone's ever read the Bible, you'll know that this description is not true. In fact, there are some parts of the Bible that are even more brutal than the TV series The Game of Thrones. And there are definitely more sex scenes in the Bible. I know that's shocking, I just said sex in a church, but it's true, there's a lot of sex in the Bible. In fact, I think the Bible is a little bit more like this. This is what Nick Page, again, that same author, says. The Bible refuses to behave itself by being nice and polite. It contains stories that children should not see and language that we'd rather they didn't hear. Remember I said that Paul swears in the Bible. But it's absolutely vital that all of this stuff is in the Bible because the Bible is about life in all its reality. And it's true, isn't it? Life is messy. Sometimes things don't go to plan. Sometimes awful things happen, and actually the Bible speaks into that. The Bible, among lots of other things, speaks about broken relationships. It speaks about sickness, about bereavement, about people struggling with depression, about suicide. But it also speaks real truth, hope, joy, love, peace. I don't know if you've ever read the Psalms in the middle of the Bible, but I think they're some of the most heartfelt poems and songs. They speak of real heartbreak, but they also speak of hope. I could have used any of the Psalms as an example, probably, but this is Psalm 31. I'm in deep, deep trouble again. I've cried my eyes out. I feel hollow inside. My life leaks away, groan by groan. My years fade out in sighs. My troubles have worn me out. They've turned my bones to powder. You don't see songs like that in the charts now, do you? You don't see that brutal honesty. Or there's this from the Book of Lamentations, which is basically just a book of moaning. This is from Lamentations 3. It says, I'll never forget the trouble, the utter lostness, the taste of ashes, the poison that I've swallowed. I remember it all. Oh, how well I remember. The feeling of hitting rock bottom. But there's one thing that I remember, and remembering I keep a grip on hope. God's loyal love could never have run out. His merciful love couldn't have dried up. They're created new every morning. How great is your faithfulness? I'm sticking with God. I'll say it over and over. He is all I've got left. I love this verse in Lamentations 3, verse 22, because it speaks so brutally honestly of the absolute despair that we can often feel if we're honest. But it doesn't leave it there. It says, here's one thing I remember, remembering I keep a grip on hope. It speaks of the amazing hope that we see within the pages of the Bible. And I don't know what you think of when you think of the Bible. As a young teenager, I really struggled with the Bible. I would sort of flip between thinking that it was really boring and being really confused by it. But a seminar that I went to at a Christian conference when I was about 15, I spent an hour in a sweaty tent, and it totally transformed the way that I saw the Bible, because this pastor called Chris Lane did the Bible in an hour. And what he had was a washing line right across the tent, and he had every single book of the Bible, so all 66 books, and he ran, literally ran, super quickly through every single book from Genesis to Revelation, and he summarized what happened in every single book. And as he did so, he went through the history, he went through the context, and he sort of painted a picture, the whole overarching story of the Bible. And it just put everything in context for me. And that doesn't mean that every time I read the Bible, I find it really easy. But because I've now got this big picture, it did make it much easier to do. Have you guys ever heard that song, I get knocked down, but I get up again? You know, I get knocked down. Okay, I have listened to that song, obviously, lots of times before. But I heard it last week, and there was something in it that I'd never noticed before. And I want you to listen to see if you can notice it. Was that amazing trumpet solo in there? Did you all know that? No? Anyway, so that is a fairly tenuous link, just to say that sometimes when I read the Bible, it's a little bit like that. I'll read something that I've read maybe 20 times before, and suddenly I'll be like, what was that in there before? I've definitely never seen that before. It's like it jumps out of the page. It's like it's the first time I've ever read it. And that's what I love about the Bible. But before I went to this seminar when I was 15, before kind of my opinion changed to the Bible, one of my favorite ways of reading the Bible was to basically challenge God and say, please, please speak to me. And then I'd just open it at random and see what happened. I don't know if any of you guys have ever done that before. And I think, you know, you sort of treat it as like a fortune cookie. What's it got to say today? And I think the danger with doing something like that is that you may turn to something like Job 19, verse 17, which says, my breath is repulsive to my wife, and I'm loathsome to my whole family. I mean, that's probably not going to give you the wisdom that you're looking for. Or maybe you'll turn to Ezekiel 23, verse 20, which is probably one of the rudest verses in the Bible, which says that she lusted after her lovers, and they had genitals that were like donkeys. Again, probably not going to give you a huge amount of wisdom if you're looking for God to kind of speak to you. And I'm not saying that that always is a bad way of reading the Bible. That's kind of what Nabil did, and it spoke really powerfully to him. And also, God is bigger than our kind of nonsense way of doing things. But I think we just need to be a little bit careful of picking and choosing random bits of the Bible without seeing them in context, without understanding how they fit sort of historically into the big story. And we don't have time today to look at how we should read the Bible. But one thing I do want to just reiterate is that within this incredible book, there are lots of different types of literature, as I've already said. And we don't read things like poetry and songs in the same way that we read the history, because they weren't intended to be read the same way. And so there are three things that I would say that have helped me read the Bible over the years. One is getting alongside people that know the Bible better than me and to read it with them. Another one is to use Bible notes to kind of look at some of the history and things like that. There's loads of great stuff on our phones actually that can do that sort of thing. And the other one is to get a kind of overview like I had as a teenager, which looks at some of the big picture of the Bible. And I've actually got, I got this guy that did the seminar to write an article for me summarizing his seminar. And I've got a couple of copies of that article if anyone wants to grab some afterwards. But what I want to say is that this Bible, which is definitely falling apart, my Bible, is more than just 66 books. This Bible is life. It's God-breathed. There's power in this book. And one of my friends told me, and I love this, we're not supposed to just read the Bible. We're supposed to inhale it. We're supposed to breathe it in. And that's what Nabil did, and he had a super powerful experience. And that's what I've done on countless occasions. And I just want to end by sharing one of those occasions with you. I was praying for a friend of mine who had been battling depression for a long, long time. And she tragically took her own life. And I was livid with God. I was like, come on, why are you not answering my prayers? Why don't you care about my friend? Have you forgotten about me? Have you forgotten about her? And I was at a Christian conference feeling really angry with God as all these amazing things were happening around me to my young people. And I just sort of took myself to the back of the conference and ranted and raved at God in my head because I'm English. And I was just so angry with God. And someone who had never met me before, didn't know anything about my situation, came and started praying for me. And as she started praying, she started to read some verses from Isaiah 49. And she started saying this, "The Lord has deserted us. The Lord has forgotten us." And I was like, you're reading my mind. That's exactly what I'm thinking, that God's forgotten about me. He's deserted me. He doesn't answer my prayers. And then she carried on reading from Isaiah 49. And so that was Jerusalem saying the Lord's forgotten us. And then comes the Lord's reply, and it says, "Never can a mother forget her nursing child. Even if that were possible, I would not forget you. See, I've written your name on the palm of my hands. Always before me is a picture of Jerusalem's walls in ruins." There is no other verse in the Bible that could have spoken to me more powerfully than that in that moment. That God had not forgotten me, that he'd seen me even in my ruins. This book is life, and God will speak to you through it if you let him. Shall we pray? God, thank you that you've not forgotten about us, that even though things are difficult and we don't always understand stuff, that you can still speak to us anyway. And we just ask that wherever we're at with you and with our relationship with the Bible, God, I just ask that you'll help us to fall more in love with it, just a little step further. And I pray that you'll show each of us how much you love us. Amen.
Let's give Ruth a round of applause, please. You don't go yet, because you're going to ask you some questions. How many of you were touched by what she said there? Was there any really thing that stood out to you? Anyone? I'm interested to find out. So someone asked me, and I couldn't answer them, the part where you said that, is that on? Yeah. The part where you said that there's swearing, that Paul swears in the Bible. Somebody asked me what was that, I was like,
So this is in Philippians 3, where Paul says, we translate it, I consider it all rubbish compared to the value of knowing Jesus and him crucified. In the Greek, the word is scandalon, and actually it's like the most vulgar language you can use to describe a rubbish heap. It's kind of the equivalent of, I'm not going to say it because I'm in a church, but
the F word.
Yeah, or
the S word.
Yeah, maybe the S word. It's like, okay, really, so I consider, dirty, so rubbish.
I consider it S word.
Yeah.
What's the rest?
I consider it rubbish compared to the value of knowing Jesus. So he's talking about all the other things that he's attained in his life, and he's just saying none of it is amounts to anything compared to knowing Jesus.
Beautiful.
But the word he uses is brutal. Okay.
So Paul swears. So is it okay to swear? I'm joking. Okay. David, do we have any questions in Slido? Or does anybody have a question? We have one. Oh, beautiful. Okay, let's go to that. Before, I'd like to invite Alex, please join us on stage. And our speakers, please come up. So literally, I'm just going to hand the mic over to you and both of you.
Both of you.
To help answer any question we might have pertaining to this particular one. Is the other mic? I'll grab a mic. What's the first one? From the first time read a Bible, where should one start? Okay, cool. Whoever wants to answer that.
I've been handed the mic. For a first time Bible reader, where would you start? I think I would start in the Gospels. If you want something short, start with Mark. And Mark's gospel starts with the beginning of the good news about Jesus Christ, the Son of God, which is just a great reminder that the message of Jesus is a person, not a group of facts. So the beginning of good news about a person, Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And so what we're being introduced to is a person. And then read the whole thing. I mean, so often actually, even as Christians, we can get through a long way through our Christian life before we've read a gospel from cover to cover. And actually, I'd encourage someone who's not a Christian, even if they've grown up in Christianity, to start there. My dad died when he was 71, about 10 years ago, and when he was about 69, he was gradually dying of cancer. I pleaded with him to read a gospel from cover to cover, and he said, well, I grew up going to boarding school where we had church and religious studies all the time. I know there's nothing that would surprise me as I read it. I said, have you ever read it from beginning to end? Well, that was the beginning of his life changing, and he gave his life to Christ in the last year of his life. So read a gospel from cover to cover.
I would say I'm on the same page as Alex. Start from the gospels, especially the book of Mark, 16 chapters. It's the shortest gospel, but with something in mind. Two questions. Who is Jesus? Tell me, Mark. If you wrote it so we can get to know who he is, who is Jesus? And I find it amazing when I'm reading Mark with people, because in chapter 2, there you go. Your sins are forgiven. Wow. Who can say that? And the second question is, why did he come? If God is in heaven, a perfect place. Why would God leave a perfect place to come to a broken world? It's not a nice place to go on holiday, right? So why did he come? So that's the second question you have to ask. Please, Mark, tell me, why did Jesus, God in flesh, come? So he came to save. God in flesh came to save. And Mark is brilliant at doing that. So I would start in Mark, read the whole Gospels, and this is my personal opinion, move to Philippians. Forget about that part. I'm joking, yeah. But it's brilliant. If you really want to follow Jesus, that's a great manual. That's a great manual, what it means to actually be a disciple of Jesus.
Sorry, I just had one thing. I totally agree with all of that. I know you're probably not really allowed a favorite gospel, but my favorite gospel is Luke. Mark is really good because it's short, but he's very like breathless. He constantly says, and immediately. And so if you've got a little bit more time and you want to just take a little bit more time to read, I would say read Luke, because Luke for me is the gospel for the outsiders. So there's a lot of women, there's a lot of children, there's a lot of people that would have been sort of marginalized and put on the edges of society that Jesus just invites in. And it's not that Mark wouldn't have talked about it, it's just that he didn't have enough room. He was just trying to get like the bare bone facts in. So Luke kind of expands a little bit. And just on that note as well, I think Luke 15 is the kind of pinnacle of the story through which actually it's really helpful to read the whole Bible through the lens of that story. It's the story of the prodigal son, where the father does everything to come and be reconciled with his son. And it's just that picture of a running father that would do anything to be with his son. And so I think if we read the whole Bible in light of that one story, that can be a really helpful thing to do as well.
Brilliant.
Luke's also great just because the introduction, if you're reading it with a non-Christian, I mean, they would say, oh, it's legend, isn't it? Luke states straight up, this is eyewitness evidence.
Second question quickly. Just to move it on, if we could get one person, because we've got quite a few questions, just to answer back. So the second question says, other faith texts also claim to be true and may have evidence to back it up. What makes the Bible different? Interesting question. Anybody?
Can I go? Just with that table that Ruth showed, I've recently, in dialoguing with Muslims, added another row for the Quran. Doesn't look great on that comparison. The first historical fact to be written down about Muhammad was 190 years after he died. That is just categorical. A Muslim can't argue with that. You can Wikipedia it, you can look it up. First historical fact written about Muhammad's life, 190 years after he died. I mean, there's probably of all faiths, Islam is the next sort of most historical. So the others would be quite happy to say they're built on legend. So actually there is no comparison.
Anybody else want to quickly take that?
Yeah, Ruth helped us to understand that the Bible is a It's a reliable collection of historical documents. It's not fairy tale. Reliable collection of historical documents written by, this is not mine anyway, I'm going to quote by the end of it, written by eyewitnesses during the lifetime of other eyewitnesses. Some of them died because they knew that is the truth. And they reported supernatural events that took place in fulfillment of specific prophecies. So even when you compare other, what we would call sacred books, wow, a lot of them have prophecies that did not take place. So I would say, yeah, the Bible is, it's full of prophecies that took place.
Beautiful. Next question says, how do we actually know that Jesus is the Son of God?
I think one of the things is that Jesus said that. Jesus said that he's the Son of God. So we've got to at least take it seriously. And there's a famous kind of argument from C.S. Lewis, which is that if Jesus said that, then there's only three options as to what he was. Either he was what he said he was, the Son of God, or he lied about being the Son of God, or he was a bad man. He was either mad, bad, or God. And if he was lying about it, he was doing it just to kind of deceive people. Or he was mad, so he thought he was the Son of God, but he wasn't actually the Son of God, or he was the Son of God. So I would say that you need to basically read Mark's Gospel, read lots of these other documents that talk about Jesus, and make up your mind for yourself. I think he's the Son of God. I think if you look at the Bible, but you also look at these other documents, I don't think there's any other solution that you can come to, really. I think particularly looking at Jesus rising from the dead, a mad man wouldn't rise from the dead, a bad man wouldn't rise from the dead, but God could do that. So I think you need to just investigate that yourself. And what I love about C.S. Lewis was he said famously that he became a Christian kind of kicking and screaming. He didn't want to become a Christian. And he said, I didn't become a Christian to kind of feel this fuzzy feeling inside. He knew that a bottle of rum could do that. But he became a Christian because he knew it was true. And so for C.S. Lewis, he kind of looked at all these facts and he begrudgingly became a Christian because he was almost compelled to.
Another way to remember the mad, bad, or God is because often people add in the extra element, but Ruth covered it brilliantly. But if you do all the L's, you've got then lunatic, legend. Legend is the first one. Legend, then mad, lunatic, liar, bad, and Lord. So legend, lunatic, liar, Lord. And most people will focus on the legend thing. I've just been listening to, because I like listening to books rather than reading them. That's my way of speed reading. A book by someone called Richard Carrier, a very, very long book, trying to prove that Jesus is a myth. What's really striking is that although his view is a minority view, in order to try and hammer home that Jesus must have been a myth, he says, what Alex was saying earlier, that he so perfectly fulfills the prophecies that are there in Isaiah and Zechariah in particular, but actually all the Old Testament, that he must have been invented to fulfill that myth. The problem with that is that the documents are so early that people would have been able to refute that. You can't invent a historical character so soon after their lifetime as legend. You can't choose where they're born. So you bring together an atheist scholar who would argue that Jesus was historically real, but it's not reliable, and then Richard Carrier saying he perfectly fulfills the prophecies. They meet in the middle. They've actually got to trust in the historical Jesus. So there's so much evidence. And I think people will say, well, didn't the myth develop that Jesus was God? Mm-hmm. Well, the earliest writings that all historians agree on are Paul. I think some of the Gospels were written earlier. I think it sounds like you do as well. But in terms of provable dates, Philippians 2 says, who being in very nature God, or who being in the form of God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage, but came down. So earliest documents claim that Jesus is God. It wasn't a myth that developed over time.
Brilliant. We're going to take a pause for the questions there, because we still have a big question and answer section. I've seen some of the questions that's come in. They're so excited. I can't actually wait for you to answer them, because I even have some more to answer myself. But we're going to move on quickly, and we're going to answer the questions later. So let's give our panelists a big round of applause, please.